Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. We launched a new Entree Architect Academy digital course. It's called Construction Management for Small Firm Architects. My small firm earned an additional $58,000 the first year we started offering construction management services to our clients. To learn more about this new digital course, visit entrearchitect.com/cmcourse. Entree Architect Podcast, episode 120. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. Many of you are working at established architecture firms, and some of you are considering the idea of launching your own firm. And I know through surveys and connecting directly with you, the Entree Architect community, all throughout the blog and the social media, that most of you are already leading your own firms. Well, what if you were to start all over? What if you were to start from scratch with the knowledge you now have? How would you structure that firm? How would you do it differently? How could you ensure that the firm is prosperous and encourages equity for everyone involved? Well, this week on the Entree Architect Podcast, I invited my friend Rosa Shang back to the show, and she shared the 7 essential elements of an equitable architecture firm. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is sponsored by FreshBooks, the easiest way to send invoices, manage expenses, and track your time. Learn more at freshbooks.com/architect. Today's guest is an architect and senior associate with one of the most admired architecture firms in the world and one of my favorites, Bolin Sawinski Jackson Architects. And she's a founding member of the Bolin Sawinski Jackson San Francisco office. And she's worked on some amazing architecture projects, including the Pixar Animation Studio headquarters and the original glass structures for Apple stores, where she had the opportunity to work with Steve Jobs personally. Pretty cool. So she sits on the board currently at the AIA San Francisco Board of Directors as treasurer. And she's one of the founders of Equity by Design. And you've heard about Equity by Design before. We've talked with this guest before. Equity by Design started as a San Francisco AIA initiative and has led to the AIA National Commission on Equity in Architecture, which is much of the result of this today's guest's consistent and passionate leadership. So, Rosa Shang, welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. I'm thrilled to be here.
Third time. Third time. The first
time's a charm.
First time you were here. You're the second third time guest ever here on Entree Architect.
Awesome.
Eric Reinholt was. We did a series, so he was on it for three times. So, you were here back in 2014 to talk about equity by design. You were episode 27, where you sort of introduced us to equity by design and what that was all about. And then after the survey, and we're going to get into this a little bit so people will know more about this.
Sure.
But episode 51 in November, after the survey was complete, you came back and you shared the results of that survey. So, but there's so much that has happened since November of 2014. So I would love for you to give us a brief reminder about what Equity by Design is, and then sort of give us the update on the progress of what's happening here today.
Sure, sure. So in a hyperspeed fashion, where we started and where it started for me as a personal journey was a point in my career where I was questioning whether I should stay in architecture. And while that might seem kind of a strange, you know, premise, I wasn't the only one feeling this way. And the more talking I did, I realized that more people were feeling frustrated with the profession in general, mostly women, but also men, to the point where it felt like something needed to be done. And when we decided to form the committee as part of AIA San Francisco, we had done a lot of reading before that to realize that there wasn't much research or data out there about the kind of conditions of practice and what people were experiencing or what people were frustrated with or going through in their life of an architect from the time that they graduated to the time of their retirement. And we knew anecdotally that a lot of people were leaving the profession, but we just didn't know how many and to what degree comparatively between men and women at that point. So when we launched the survey in early 2014, that was one of our goals. It was a grassroots effort. We had done it by a popular survey through the internet, through social media. That survey garnered 2,300 respondents. And then we launched the results in October 2014 at the symposium that you attended, Equity by Design. So that was it was called the Missing 32% before, and some people might hear that name bounced around. But it evolved into Equity by Design because it really aimed at capturing a larger kind of conversation about the state of practice, what wasn't working, how we could do better to not only improve the conditions for people that are architects and designers, but also the clients, the people that ultimately end up being the occupants of the buildings that we design. So that was an explosion because we didn't realize the nature of the need for the data or the backup for what people were feeling out there. We kind of used a concept of life of an architect, career pinch points. You might have heard of where, you know, through the your course of practicing professional advancement, you could go through potential hurdles or challenges that cause you to leave the profession, whether it be hiring, whether there's a good economy or bad economy, whether there's paying your dues as a young professional, you know, between the time that you get hired and you get licensed, the challenges of licensure itself and the kind of jumping through hoops that used to happen that prolonged the entire process, caregiving being a major concern, and not just parents. We want to clarify that caregiving expands to caring for parents and caring for yourself. You know, we ignore the health of our bodies when we do all-nighters and we work incessantly, but that stress ultimately comes back in terrible forms, you know, whether it's chronic disease or even death for some people, based on heart attacks or, you know, cancer or something. But that's important, a topic to, you know, be mindful of. And then finally, implicit bias or the glass ceiling. There's a lot keeping people from advancing into leadership positions and ultimately becoming disenfranchised and either, you know, starting their own practice or leaving the profession entirely. So that's in a nutshell of, you know, what we were trying to get after. And again, the need was so great that not only did I end up speaking at the symposium, but a group of us started sharing the presentation of the survey results in a kind of a traveling presentation. I was joking around that we were going to take it on a roadshow, and I didn't realize the reality of my what I said. You know, I have to be careful when I speak. But I ended up going all over the United States, basically to major metropolitan areas, and then even to Lisbon, Portugal, in the summer of 2015, spring of 2015. And you know, it's been widely received as the start of valuable information that people need in order to sustain themselves in the profession. It's just, there's not enough information out there is what we realized. So it's been a good catalyst for discussion. It's brought about a lot of connections with groups around the world, actually, that are trying to spearhead this very topic of not just lack of women in the profession and leadership roles, but lack of minorities in the profession and leadership roles as well, and just struggles that everybody goes through right now with long hours, low pay, lack of negotiation skills. You know, the list goes on and on of things that we could do better to improve our profession and the sustainability of people, you know, practicing.
Right. The results of the survey really talked not only to women and minorities, but it talked about to the entire profession. Everything that it discussed were things that would benefit everybody.
Yes. Yes. And there's a lot of mixed results as far as how people feel. You know, I think a lot of people are fearful that if we expand the conversation in this umbrella, this wider net fashion, mm-hmm. that we'll forget our roots of, you know, fighting for the people that are marginalized, you know, the women, the minorities. But I think in bringing this conversation out of the back room into the mainstream, we're actually doing better service to, you know, everybody that feels disenfranchised at this point. Because it's not a sidebar conversation. It's actually something that is important and relevant to everybody. So that's why our tagline is equity is for everyone. You know, and why does equity matter? We can expand upon that. The other things that we've done is action oriented. So it's not just about the knowledge. It's not just about talking about it. It's committing to doing something to change the ratio or to change your status quo of whatever's dissatisfactory, right? Mm-hmm. Within your own career, but also within your firm, within the profession at large. There's different scales of action, right? And each person, you know, we joke around calling it biting the, you know, eating the whale and biting little bits at a time of what you're able to chew. But it really is that kind of aggregate grassroots effort of people collectively choosing to take that bite, what their part is, and then watching it all kind of come together. So on our end, we are spearheading research and we continue to do so. We just finished the 2016 survey, which was amazing. I can't give exact numbers yet, but we are over 3x of our responses from 2014. So if that gives you a scale of involvement, we used a different strategy. We were legit this time in terms of how we garnered our responses. We send out emails instead of social media. It was kind of this research, professional researchers' recommendations of, you know, how to make your survey legitimate and prevent what they call self-selection bias. Like the people that take the survey are only those that are interested or, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid.
which wasn't intentional. It just because it was the first time around, that's how it was done.
That's right. That's right. So we're learning and we're improving. And we had, and again, roughly 50-50 men, women this time around, which, you know, isn't the profession, but it is society. So at least we're mirroring what society is as far as the respondents. And the questions that we asked some of the same questions so that we can, you know, compare 2014 to 2016. But we also had different new questions and trajectories of conversation about engagement versus burnout. You know, there's factors that contribute to that. And we mirrored a case studies research questions in the new survey to be able to determine, you know, how likely a person is to either, you know, be engaged or be burnt out. The likeliness increases if they answer certain questions a specific way. And we also spent a little more time on the caregiving conundrum, you know, of paid leave and, you know, balancing hours and just flexible hours, you know, things that people traditionally think of as a women's issue or mother's issue is actually expanded to be everybody's issue because it's part of that burnout conversation. If, you know, you're, you know, burning the midnight oil, there's no sustainability in that, even if you're, you know, a male and you're single, you know, it's going to catch up with you sooner or later, whether it's your health or, you know, just personal sanity. So everybody deserves a crack at a, you know, decent work hours, the flexibility to be able to do things that resuscitate their passion, you know, renewed passion in what they're doing, kind of feeding, you know, into, you know, renewing what works for us. And then also making sure that, you know, building in ahead of time the structure that will allow for healthy lifestyles, whether you have a family or you decide you want to teach or, you know, whatever it is you want to do on the side of being an architect, you should be allowed to do that. It shouldn't be a, oh, you're, you know, betraying your profession or whatever it is that we used to say.
Right.
It's a bigger conversation.
Yeah, I love it. And what about, I mean, is this all being managed still by San Francisco or what's the connection between the AIA San Francisco and the AIA National Commission that's been formed?
Yes. So I forgot to mention, and thank you for reminding me that having the data and the research wasn't enough. So action and activism, we co-authored a resolution that was voted at the 2015 AIA National Convention in Atlanta, Resolution 15.1. And that was a call for AIA National to start an equity and architecture commission that would spearhead this issue, study the importance of it, and really determine what next steps need to be taken within AIA National to support the equity and architecture conversation. So that group, which I am part of, has met twice already, and we have another meeting, our last technical meeting in person in June. Our work will not finish, though, until the end of the year when we make our official recommendations to AIA National about next steps of what we would like to see happen, AIA supporting as far as equity and architecture, equitable practice, and whether it's you know, awards and recognition, or whether it's you know, strengthening the pipeline and determining research, you know, continuing research, whatever it is, that will be the kind of recommendations. And then it needs to be reviewed by the board and, you know, approved as far as a short-term plan and then a long-term plan. So, yeah, that's the action part of it. And then we've also been doing programs. So we tried a bunch of workshops out to address some of these issues. And they're repeating themselves. They're so popular that they're repeating themselves again at convention. We tried them in Atlanta, and you may have heard of the hackathon.
Yep.
So that was our first stab at doing something, again, disrupting even workshops and how they're presented at AIA National Convention. So a hackathon is actually a techie name for a charrette with a tech component in terms of, it's almost like a business plan of startup, but you know, harnessing creativity. And it's really retraining us on how to think the way we used to think in school, where we said, what if, when there was no constraints on us, and to really expand the envelope of possibilities to create solutions on how we address some of these issues. So last year was just kind of a broad umbrella approach, but the winning team had this great idea of solving the lack of mentorship. So their group was called Build Your Tribe, and their kind of business plan was to build an app that would allow people to list their affinities of what their career passions and goals were, and to find people with those similar affinities so that they could actually form bonds and champions, if you will, and mentors to be able to support their career goals. So it's like examples like that. And then this year, the conversation is about architecture and how can we expand the role of an architect into the future, because traditional practice as we do now isn't going to, you know, cut it in the future, because technology is advancing so quickly that if we don't keep up, if we don't, you know, become more future thinking, we're going to be left behind. So that hackathon, which Phil Bernstein is one of the presenters, he is from Autodesk. He wrote this manifesto about architecture and the era of connection. And that was really inspiring to me, you know, and I thought this is a great topic and so appropriate for the time we're at now of invention and creation, and how that can support equitable practice is that if we are the leaders of, and the innovators, you basically write your own ticket, right? If you are the startup of a company or something that's cutting edge, you could basically determine how you run your practice instead of being told how to run your practice. And that's where equity and architecture comes into play, is that the innovators, the leaders of tomorrow, really get baked in that that equitable practice is important, and each, you know, part of that process.
Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to FreshBooks for their support as a platform sponsor of Entree Architect. Because as a platform sponsor, FreshBooks has provided funding and support for our overall mission here at Entree Architect to be an influential force in the profession of architecture. They recognize the need for small firms to build better businesses in order to be better architects. FreshBooks is the easy-to-use accounting software designed to help us small firm owners get organized, save time, and get paid faster. It takes care of invoicing, expense tracking, estimating, reporting, everything you need, and it all happens out in the cloud, so you have access to your information from anywhere you have access to the internet. And as an exclusive offering just for the Entree Architect community, I've asked FreshBooks to join me on video and show us around the product, FreshBooks. I know that once you see how easy it is to set up and how simple it is to use, you will convert to FreshBooks just like I did for Five Cat Studio. Tim Lee of FreshBooks and I produced a series of videos, and they're available for free at entrearchitect.com/freshbooksvideo. And when you're ready to give FreshBooks a try, go to freshbooks.com/architect and sign up for a free 30-day trial. It's free. No questions asked. It's free. 30 days. Just go in there and set up one client. Send one invoice. Set up a credit card payment system and have that invoice paid faster than you ever imagined it would get paid by credit card. It goes right into your bank account. I love it. So freshbooks.com/architect. Sign up for your free 30-day trial right now. Give it a shot. And be sure to let them know that we sent you. Put in Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About It section. And that leads perfectly into what I want to talk about today on the podcast here.
Yes.
What I want to, as many of you know who listen to the podcast, every month we're talking about a different subject this year. And April, the topic is culture. And I wanted Rosa to come and give us an update on Equity by Design and what's going on. And it's very exciting to hear the progress that it's made. It's amazing how much progress has been made in the amount of time since we've last spoken here. But I wanted Rosa to come back and talk about culture and how equity affects culture, firm culture, and how firm culture affects equity. And sort of very much like the hackathon, sort of give the question to Rosa, if we are going to build a firm from scratch, what are the things that we'd want to do? How can we be intentional about designing a firm around a culture that is based on equity? What are the things that we do? What policies should we institute? What systems should we have? What are the benefits we should have? What are the things that we should be looking at sort of as a checklist to make sure that we're developing a firm culture from the very beginning, even before it's born, to make sure that as this firm grows, it becomes the thing it should be. Do you have a place to start with that conversation?
Absolutely. And it's part of the national conversation beyond architects and our profession. It's in the presidential election, in international conversations, it's really on the forefront of what we need to do as a profession to just keep up. So I'd like to start with the fact that a lot of people are confused by the term equity and equality, and they use them interchangeably.
Okay.
So just first off the bat, equity is actually about recognizing difference and providing just and fair opportunities for people to have access, to success, the same access. And equality is about sameness and recognizing that everybody gets the same piece of the pie, but it doesn't recognize difference. So, to use the terms interchangeably doesn't really work because they're saying different things.
Yeah.
And the baseball field analogy that I'll just mention quickly. So on the equity side, sorry, on the equality side, everybody, imagine if you will, there's a tall person, a medium height person, and a short person. They all get the same thing in the equality equation. So they get a box to stand on. The tall person who could see fine gets a box, but he doesn't really need it, or she doesn't really need it. The medium person couldn't see over the fence, but gets to see with the box. The short person, unfortunately, cannot see over the fence, even though they have the same thing as everybody else, right? So that's equality. You have the same thing.
Yeah.
But on the equity equation, you basically have the taller person recognizing they don't need the box. They can see over the fence regardless. They recognize that the short person can't see, gives the box to the short person, and then it's a win-win for everybody. It's that awareness and recognition that there's differences, and people have different challenges too. Not everybody's going to have, it's not a charity case. You might have a different challenge from your coworker. And then if everybody recognizes that everybody has differences and challenges and comes to the table to say, well, I don't need this, but I need that, you know, and vice versa. That's the start of equitable practice, is that mindset.
Okay. So the first step is to acknowledge this mindset.
Yes.
Got it.
Absolutely. And it goes with, you know, implicit bias training, unconscious bias training. We are all born with bias. It is a very primal thing. It's a survival skill. You have to be able to sense danger, you know, and not trust everything, not put like poison in your mouth, or not trust people that might kill you, right? But it has evolved where it's so structurally built into us to think a certain way that it's actually preventing us from hiring, you know, certain people. And it's been proven in different studies with like Harvard Business Review and, you know, cutting edge business practices where time and time again, if they gave you a dummy resume and they put the name of same resume, if they put a name of a guy and they put a name of a woman, the woman is perceived in a different way than the man, even though it's a factor, you know, it's a fabricated resume. And similarly with a fabricated resume and different names. So ethnically diverse names, you know, that are very obvious versus traditionally Caucasian names, again, those people were less likely to be called for an interview. So they're learning these really fascinating things, and just being aware that those biases are out there. And right. Also there's a place that you could take the implicit bias test for various things just to be more self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then saying that, okay, I know these things about myself, how can I change them to improve the workplace culture so that I'm not just hiring people like myself, right? You know, I could have a tendency to hire people just like myself, but to know that about myself and then to kind of consciously correct for that, knowing that ultimately, there's a business case for having a more diverse workforce, not just culturally or along gender lines, but just different skill sets. So if we could build the optimal team, they would all have different skills that would kind of slightly overlap, but then we'd have the broader range of skills covered, right? Versus everybody having the same skill set and then us having holes in our practice because we don't have those other skills. So that's a starting point.
Right. And then the implicit bias, you said that everybody has that. So again, that's sort of being self-aware and recognizing that we all have bias and just acknowledging that is a first step and say, okay, well, when I do start hiring and when I do start making decisions, be aware that when you get those resumes and when you get those decisions to make, that's there. And
yes.
just acknowledging that that's there, you may be able to overcome that implicit bias and say, well, wait a minute, what am I doing here? Let's look at this beyond that and let's see what else is there.
Yes. And they did a study with symphonies where they actually did blind trials and people were playing music behind curtains. And it did two things. One, it removed the implicit bias of seeing the person before they judged them by their performance of the music. But then it also freed up people who are afraid of going, thinking, well, they're going to have a bias against me. They're not going to pick me anyway, to actually try out. You know, so it increases the pipeline because less people are deterred, thinking, oh, there's a bias there. I'm not even going to try. And then also helping remove the bias by having that blind, the curtain, right? So in our practice, we can think of, well, how can we take that concept and make it an even more more even playing field, right? Whether it's, you know, removing the names from the resume, or, you know, conducting, you know, I don't know the exact answer just yet, but there's different things that we could brainstorm about making it a more even playing field.
Right. And that might be a system that you put together when you're, when you put together your hiring system for your firm.
That's right.
Create these systems that, that in order to acknowledge this implicit bias, let's create a way that, that these decisions are being made, that, that you're acknowledging this. Maybe you take the names off. Maybe you create some way of going through this and filtering out the resumes, so you don't know, you know, whether it's a man or a woman, or whether it's a, you know, a Caucasian or a, an ethnic name. You won't
That's
know.
Right.
You just make the decision, and then once you make that decision, then you find out all that information. That could just
exactly.
be a policy and system that's built into your firm.
Absolutely. And we did a mini trial of that. So we had scholarships for the AIA hackathon this year, and I hid all the names of the people, and I gave the kind of the submission, their answers to the judges. Mm-hmm. So it was literally a blind jury of just judging them by what they wrote, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know,
practicing,
we did get
what you preach.
Ultimate diversity that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's another step we can take?
Also, I think on the scheduling front, this is low-hanging fruit of work-life flexibility or integration or fit. You know, we have different names for it. But it's acknowledging that people have different schedules. You know, it's impossible that we all have the same schedule. So 9 to 5 doesn't work anymore. People have early starts or late starts because of family or personal reasons, et cetera. So why don't we have core hours? There's a bunch of firms that are actually practicing that, where they try to schedule the bulk of their meetings within what they determine as being their core hours, whether it's 10 to 4 or you know, 9 to 3, whatever everybody agrees on is the majority of the time that people are in. Those are where the meetings get scheduled. And then, you know, people will have to come and go early or leave late. It's something that they actually do at one of my children's school with the reading and split reading. So some of the kids come in early, some of the kids come in late, but then they're all there together in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I love that idea. I've never heard of that, but it makes it so simple. It's such a simple solution to that problem.
It avoids the stress of people missing out because they're not there. I mean, there's always going to be exceptions to the rule, but if everybody just tried really hard to follow core hours, it would make such a world of difference.
Right, right.
And then even alongside of that is leave of absences, right? So again, the traditional one that everybody thinks about is maternity leave. Well, it also extends into paternity leave, family leave, of the different family situations that people have. You may be a guardian or adopt children, or you may be taking care of an elderly parent or relative, and you may need to take leave. And with the architects traditionally, you know, salary being lower than other professions, that has an impact of not getting paid. Unpaid leave has a huge impact on a person's livelihood. So developing a paid leave policy, we are seeing it now in government, where it's actually San Francisco passed a law recently requiring, you know, a paid leave for employers with 50 employees or more to provide that. Luckily in California, two-thirds of that is supplemented in a short-term disability insurance. So luckily for the California firms, that just means if you're in San Francisco for this particular bill that got passed, it would mean you would pay the third difference so that that person would have 100% coverage for their 6 to 8 weeks or whatever that the policy is in place. And again, that's the difference between somebody, you know, going into debt or losing their job or deciding, you know, it's not worth it. I'm going to find another job or a profession. You know, it's a big difference,
right?
For people to feel supported when they need it.
And if you're building that into your firm from the beginning, like we're talking about here, from the other side, from the business side of you, because you look at that from the business owner's side of you, point of view, you have to pay for that. And so to have the opportunity to have some of that supplemented would be great. But even if you didn't, even if you did offer paid leave in full, if you built that into the finances of your firm and you had that that fund for those opportunities to happen, that could happen. It's just a matter of how you structure your firm and how you structure your finances.
That's right. And there has to be a way to structure this as some kind of reserve fund. But think of paid sick days. Usually you don't use all of your sick days within a year. I don't know if your firm rolls them over, but many firms only roll over holiday time, you know, at a request or hardship. But the sick days kind of just disappear. Like if you don't use them, they go away. What if there was a way to capture the sick pay, even though it's, you know, financially structured differently, to put that into that rainy day fund to be able to fund the paid leave, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, it could be an incentive where employees somehow get to, you know, the longer they stay at a firm, they can't, you know, maybe there's a way that they don't bankroll it and use it all at the same time. But again, if there's a hardship or an emergency, that they be able to tap into that resource, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think those are great ideas.
Yeah. So there's ways around it, right? It's just like leveraging what you have and trying to build in that insurance system internally, you know, and maybe there's a way to set up some kind of mutual fund or something, you know, maybe there's a way to adopt a law because they started the college fund that way by people, you know, lobbying for that. Maybe there's an advocacy thing for, you know, paid sick leave insurance that is, you know, built into that unpaid time.
Right. Right. I mean, when we build businesses, many of us are building businesses around offering the benefits of full health insurance and bonuses and all the other things that we look at as compensation and benefits.
Right.
This can be looked at the same way that paid leave is part of part of your benefits.
That's right.
And you can use it whether you need it or not. That it becomes one of the benefits you have, like a vacation, but it's
Absolutely.
Not a vacation.
It could be a sabbatical, you know. There should be a recognition that people get burnt out. And would you rather have a person leave forever? Or would you be able to say to them, you know what, go take your 3 months, go find yourself or go refresh yourself, but we want you to come back.
Right.
Wouldn't that be incredible to have that
stronger
as an
option? With more knowledge and rested and ready to roll.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else? We have to have the mindset of equity, we have implicit bias and self-awareness. We have work-life integration and work hours and core hours, that sort of that area, and then leave of absences. What about a fifth one?
Mentorship.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Building a culture of mentorship, not as something that's a checklist or a requirement, but finding affinities. You know, what are your passions? Allowing a culture that supports this kind of organic mentorship, you know, creating a culture that really celebrates people's unique skill sets and allows that to feed back into the firm, you know, whether it's formal programs or informal chats, you know, whether it's book clubs or whatever it is that enforces a culture that allows people to get to know each other, you know, that's the core of mentorship. And then champions, right? So extending to beyond mentorship, learning from other people and their expertise. And it doesn't have to be top down where it's just older people mentoring younger people. Younger people can mentor older people as well, reverse mentorship or peer mentorship, because, you know, technology is advancing so rapidly. We actually should be depending on the younger people to teach the older people how to keep up.
And I saw that happen when I was a youngster. Because I came in just as computers started working, you know, as they brought CAD into the studios. And that's exactly what happened, is that the young architects in the studio who were learning how to run these CAD machines were teaching the older generation how to do it.
Yeah.
So we were mentoring them.
Absolutely. And then champions, I've mentioned before, but people that purposefully and conscientiously look out for you as far as you know, what you've done in your career advancement, your professional development, and when it comes time for the employee review or even decisions about promotions, that they're at the table, you know, and extending upon that, we shouldn't, ultimately, if you built an equitable practice, you wouldn't really need champions. Champions is kind of a band-aid for where we currently are now, like pre-ideal utopian workplace. Yeah. But in a utopian workplace where equitable practice is baked in, you would have a clear, transparent promotion policy, right? And you'd have bias awareness so that people who tend to not get promoted, right, would get the benefit of the doubt and would have, you know, stronger mentorship relationships with people so that one could say, well, you know, I didn't know so-and-so before, but because of this culture of mentorship, I know them now. And I know that, you know, they're capable of doing this if they get a certain amount of support, just as an example. So I think that was one of the top issues for people leaving firms, was that there was no clear, transparent promotion policy, clear criteria of how you advance in a firm. What skill sets do I need in order to advance? And, you know, what's going to prevent me from advancing should be clear as well.
Right. And so that would be the sixth one. So you have, you have the equity and champion, you have mentorship and champions sort of as the fifth one. And then the sixth one, because I didn't actually intend to number these, but these are a great recipe for an equitable firm.
That's right.
Yeah. So the sixth one is this clear, transparent promotion policy.
That's
Make
right.
sure everybody knows how to take the steps to get to where you want to go. And when you make those steps, there's a clear way to activate the promotion that it happened.
Correct. Just linear promotion of titles. And, you know, there can only be so many partners in a firm. You know, what are the other opportunities that we can encourage people and to say, you know what, it's okay. Ultimately, you might not be a principal in this firm, but we want you to succeed, you know, whatever you end up doing. You know, it's good for people to know that early too, versus you'll have an advocate forever versus people being disenfranchised and you losing that person forever, you know, and who knows where that person's going to show up. They could be your client, you know, in a couple of other years, but then you treated that person poorly. You weren't very upfront with the fact that they weren't going to become a principal in the firm. And then you severed that relationship, right?
Right.
So if we could just be a little more transparent, you know, and I think people, you know, while they may be disappointed to know that they're not going to be the principal or they're not quite aligned, I think it's also beneficial for that person to know that and to realize that they're not quite aligned with that particular firm and to move on and seek other opportunities, right?
Exactly. So that's six, and we could go on and on. Is there any others that are really important that we should talk about?
Those are the major six.
Okay.
There's obviously like some conversations.
Yeah.
But those are the prime six, I think, that if we could start a, you know, an equitable practice ideal firm, that would be it.
So you want to do this? You want to start a firm?
Start a firm.
we could start two offices, one in New York with me and one in San Francisco with you. We just laid out the business plan, so we're ready to roll. I'm in. And I know a bunch of other people that we could hire tomorrow.
That's great.
So let's just review them real quick. So mindset for equity.
That's right.
Implicit bias and just self-awareness about implicit bias. Work-life integration and flexible hours and core hours. The fourth one is leave of absence. Fifth one is mentorships and champions. And the sixth one is a clear, transparent promotion policy.
Yes.
So I like that. So that's the recipe for an equitable firm. So anybody who's planning on starting a firm, you can take this checklist and make sure that, you know, that's part of your business plan. You can take these six pieces and actually plug them right into your business plan on how you're going to develop your firm and answer these questions in a business plan. It's a great way to make sure that you've started the culture to be an equitable culture from the very beginning.
And I'm going to add a seventh one, and okay. It's a quick one. It's metrics. You can't know how you're progressing if you don't self-measure. And then I, of course, egregiously left out pay equity, but that seems like so obvious to me that should be taken care of, you know, in the next year or so. We shouldn't be paying people differently for doing the same things. So being able to look at your payroll and say on an annual basis, how are we doing? Are we hiring in a diverse way? Are we paying people in an equitable way? That's the seventh one. Say you're going to do it. The only way to know that you're actually doing it is to check your metrics.
We're going to have all of this in the show notes, so everybody can also just go to entrearchitect.com/episode120 and get that. So that'll be there. So Rosa, before we go, do you want to talk a little bit more about the hackathon and how people can get involved in that at the AIA convention this year?
Yes. So it's not too late. There's, I believe, the deadline for the reduced registration is Wednesday, April 20th. And we have an exciting lineup. Not only do we have the hackathon from 1 to 5 p.m. on May 18th, but we also have a happy hour component. So if you register for the hackathon, you get happy hour for free. That's kind of our little bonus, you know, that will give you drinks and food for your troubles. But we plan to have a really fun event. The first part will be entrepreneurs and disruptors and innovators kind of giving us the recipe of how they became what they are and kind of infusing us with their thought process. And then the second half will be actively forming teams to come up with a business plan. Either you can come up with one and bring it with you and then try to convince others of your great, brilliant business plan for a different type of practice, you know, in the future. Or you can, you know, come not having anything and then just brainstorm with your team that develops during the event itself. And then we will have documentation about each of the team's proposals, and we'll be sharing that in ultimately a kind of recap booklet at the end of the event, probably like a month after the fact. But there will be a winner. We're still trying to figure out what the prize is for that. And then that will be announced at the happy hour. If you can't come to the hackathon because of whatever schedule conflict, you can purchase a discounted ticket to the happy hour. We kind of reduced the rates because we are able to secure sponsors for the event. But we'd love for you to join us to participate and understand like what happened at the event. And you know, we're hoping to get a lot of good ideas that could be used into the future to develop equitable practice firms.
Well, that's exciting. I'll be at the convention, and I will be at the happy hour. Yay. I do have a conflict for the hackathon, or else I will definitely be there with my own team ready to take it away. but I'm working with the business plan competition and have a conflict. But I will be there for the happy hour. So anybody who wants to meet me there, I'd love to meet you there.
Yes, so, it will be at Smoking Betty's, which is near the convention center, very close.
Very cool. Smoking Betty's sounds like a good place.
Yes, barbecue.
Very good. So, Rosa, your internet world, your world on the internet is eqxdesign.com for Equity by Design. So it's eqxdesign.com is the website.
Yes.
And on Twitter, very active on Twitter, it's EquityXDesign, so Equity by Design, but EquityXDesign on Twitter. And on Facebook, you can find Rosa on Facebook at facebook.com spelled out Equity by Design. So it's Equity BY Design on Facebook. And that all these will be on the show notes as well. And is there anything else that you want to share before we go, Rosa?
Yes.
Any other place where people can find you?
Yes. So we're actually in construction right now with a new website. And you probably ask, like, why do you need another website? The idea of the Equity Alliance has been baking for a long time. So it's in its beta form right now, the Equity Alliance, all spelled out, .com. And
it's
the
Equity Alliance?
Yes, the okay. Equity Alliance.
Okay.
Because there is already without the you know, out there domain-wise. So we're the Equity Alliance. And the concept is that there's other groups out there besides Equity by Design doing amazing work to advance, whether changing the ratio or advancing equitable practice. A lot of people doing awards and recognition. So we are trying to aggregate all those people into a single directory and calendar and blog. So that would be the go-to place if you are anywhere around the world wanting to participate in a larger conversation. So the tagline is equity is for everyone, anywhere in the world.
Love it.
And we're really excited about that website's development to aggregate all the great initiatives happening out there.
Rosa, it's an honor to be your friend. And I'm so impressed with what you've done in the past few years. You're an inspiration to many. Thank you very much for your service to the profession of architecture and for sharing your knowledge here at Entre Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me, and it's a pleasure as always.
A direct link to download this episode and complete show notes with all the information we discussed in this episode, including information about the Equity by Design Hackathon on May 18th. It can all be found at entrearchitect.com/episode120. And if you are planning on attending AIA convention in Philadelphia, come join us too. On May 19th at 8 p.m., we're having the first ever Entre Architect meetup. And I want to meet you. So we've organized a free event just for you, the Entre Architect community. For more information about the meetup and to RSVP, just visit entrearchitect.com/meetup, and I'll see you there. And don't forget to go to iTunes, entrearchitect.com/iTunes, and leave me a review. Click the star. Let me know what you think. You can check us out on Facebook at entrearchitect.com/group. At the Entre Architect Facebook group. And don't forget to check us out, the newest Entre Architect Academy digital course, Construction Management for Small Firm Architects. It's a good one. To learn more, visit entrearchitect.com/cmcourse. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to get out there and share what you know. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
you know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gehry. Visit glengehry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.